Court has one matter for hearing today at 10 o'clock. The justices that will be hearing the matter are myself, Wade Birdwell, to my right, Justice Dana Womack to my left, Justice Mike Wallach, and we understand the parties are ready and counsel are ready. So, Bonnie, if you would go ahead and call the case.
The court will now call Boxer Property Management Corporation versus Teresa Arsenal. Defendant's support, Mr. Mark Roberts, will argue for the appellant and cross appellee. Mr. Jason Smith will argue for the appellee and cross appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is a case where the trial court granted exemplary damages, even though the jury stated both in writing and in open court that it was non-unanimous. It's a case where back pay was awarded, even though the employee unequivocally testified that she intended to resign on the day that she was terminated. It's a case where mental anguish damages were awarded without any evidence of the nature, duration, and severity of them, and a case where a decision maker who terminated the employee had no knowledge of any prior allegation or discrimination. I'd like to jump into the exemplary damages issues in the case first. Before I do need to make the court aware of, in preparation for this, there's a case that has been where petition for review has been granted by the Supreme Court. That is Bruce versus Oscar Rinda Construction, 657 Southwest 3rd, 435. It touches on the issue of exemplary damages. I think it's distinguishable. It wasn't briefed by either party. Like I say, the Supreme Court just granted a review. We're happy to provide additional briefing if the court desires. But I'll briefly mention that in a minute. In this case, the jury, in their certificate, stated, our verdict is not unanimous. 11 of us have agreed to each and every answer and have signed the certificate below. They said each and every answer was non-unanimous. In addition to that, when the trial court called them out to receive the verdict, she asked them twice whether or not the verdict was unanimous, and they said that's correct. They didn't provide a qualification. They didn't say some of them were unanimous, answers were some were unanimous and some weren't. They said it was non-unanimous. Those are the exact same facts as in the Redwine versus Peckinpah case that we cited. And based on those facts, the Redwine case found the record in this case reflects that the jury verdict was not unanimous, and it reversed the award of exemplary damages in this case. Simply put, we think that that holding and that logic is controlling and that this court should follow it.
Why is there not a conflict when the instructions to the jury say that you had your findings to these questions had to be unanimous before you go to the next question? At the end, they say we're not unanimous. Why is that not a conflict which has to be raised before the verdict is received and accepted?
Rule 295 discusses where there's conflicts in answers, conflicts where the jury answered one answer in a way and answered another answer in another way, and that triggers a conflict in answers, in which case that could trigger one party having to raise the issue with the court, perhaps for further deliberations. There's no conflict in the answers in this case. There's an answer, and there's a certificate that says each and every answer was not unanimous. Why they filled out that space for the exemplary damages, we don't know, but their representation, both in writing, signed by 11, and asked twice in open court, was that it was not unanimous. So I don't see why that triggers any duty on, in this case, Boxer, the defendant, the employer, to have to object to it. In fact, If I have some duty to object, that puts me in a very precarious position, because as the defendant, I'm required to advocate for my client. And trying to point out some defect in the wording that no other party objected to and sending a jury in for further deliberation is against my client's interest.
Counsel, the statute doesn't say that the verdict has to be unanimous with regard to exemplary damages, does it?
The
verdict doesn't show up anywhere in the statute, does it? The word verdict.
The verdict, I
the
don't believe it does.
The finding has to be unanimous, but the verdict is, the word verdict is not used in Chapter 41, is it?
I don't believe so.
Okay. So when you actually look at the instructions provided to the jury here, it does say our verdict is not unanimous. And then 11 of us have agreed to each and every answer, okay, and have signed the certificate below. And the instruction on page 90 of the record, if 11 jurors agree on every answer, those 11 jurors sign the verdict. So all they're representing here is that 11 of us could agree on every answer, including the no answers, okay, which is why the verdict is not unanimous. But it says absolutely nothing about the exemplary damages findings or answers being non-unanimous whatsoever. And in fact, they're specifically instructed they can't even answer any of those things unless the liability question was answered unanimously by the panel, by the jury. So why are we interpreting the statute to mean it has to be a unanimous verdict when in fact, if they followed the instructions the court gave them, they were unanimous on the retaliation finding, they were unanimous on the malice finding, and they were unanimous on the amount of exemplary damages.
Your Honor, I disagree. It says 11 of us have agreed to each and every answer and have signed the certificate below.
But that doesn't exclude 12 of them agreeing to the retaliatory answer, the malice answer, and the exemplary answer, because they clearly answered no on the discrimination questions. Okay, so you're asking us to interpret the we weren't unanimous to mean that they couldn't agree on any of these questions when that's not actually what that says. The verdict is not unanimous, and only 11 of them could agree to all of the answers, but that doesn't exclude all 12 of them agreeing to the answers that they were instructed they could only answer if, in fact, they were unanimous.
I believe the Civil Practices and Remedies Code and the Rule of Civil Procedure requires them to get a unanimous finding. In the verdict, they represent 11 of us have agreed to each and every answer. That indicates that only 11 agreed to each and every answer.
Why is that not also consistent with 11 of us have agreed on all the answers, but 12 of us may have agreed on some of the answers? Why is that inconsistent?
Because I would have expected them, when they were asked in open court, was this unanimous? If they had answered some of them unanimously, why didn't someone stand up and say, well, some of these were unanimous?
Because they were asked about the verdict, and it wasn't a unanimous verdict. They weren't asked about each of the answers. Was your answer to question number one unanimous? Was your answer to question number two unanimous? Was your answer to question number three unanimous? They were simply asked whether or not the verdict was non-unanimous, and that's what they answered. They answered the questions that were put to them. And we're supposed to presume that they follow the instructions.
No, you're only required to presume they followed the instructions when there is an absence in the record of evidence to the contrary.
Well, here they're told, don't answer the malice question unless you have answered either one, two, or three unanimously. Okay? So when they answer the malice question, that is effectively a finding that we answered either one, two, or three unanimously. And because three was the retaliation answer And therefore, they could only answer the malice question if they unanimously answered three yes. By answering the malice question, they effectively found we answered that unanimously. And then they did the exact same thing when they were told they couldn't answer the exemplary damages unless they had found malice unanimously.
I believe you're making a presumption that they followed those instructions. That presumption only applies as long as there's not evidence to the contrary. And they stated in writing and on the record that it was not unanimous.
They said the verdict was not unanimous. What evidence do you have that the other than they're saying the verdict was not unanimous for question three not being unanimous and for malice not being unanimous and for the exemplary damages finding not being unanimous? In other words, what question do you have, what evidence do you have that they didn't follow the instructions of the trial court?
First of all, again, 11 of us have agreed to each and every answer. That's one instance. There is also,
again, 11 people can agree to all of the answers. That doesn't mean that 12 of them didn't agree to some of the answers. Why is that mutually inconsistent? They're mutually exclusive. I mean,
because there's another place for them to check off that 12 of us have agreed.
But that would require 12 of them to answer all of the questions the same way. But you could have 12 answering some, 11 answering others, and it's still with the same answer.
Your Honor, we don't know why they did this. We don't know, but there was, under Rule 226A, the ability to put in an additional certificate for them to answer which ones were and weren't unanimous.
Anyone raise that? Did anyone make an objection to the charge based on that?
Not on the record, Your Honor. No. But the point being, it's plaintiff's burden in this case, the burden of proof and the burden to secure the findings it needs to support a judgment. And if this was a poorly worded or inaccurate jury charge, that's something that the plaintiff has a burden of securing.
Okay, this complies with the PJC. Okay, it complies with the PJC, specifically the language, the instructions with regard to unanimity. It's absolutely in conformity with the PJC. So what you're basically asking us to find is that in every instance that a plaintiff does not prove unanimously each and every cause of action they've asserted and presented to the jury, and there's not unanimity with regard to one of those in some way, shape, or form, that it basically just wipes out. Even though the jury may have found not only unanimously that you were retaliating and unanimously that you did so maliciously and unanimously assigned the amount, okay, but because of that little ambiguity that nobody raised and doesn't show up anywhere in the PJC, we're going to wipe out every one of those verdicts.
I disagree, Your Honor. This, as worded, it does not comply with Rule 226A. Neither party brought that up. But it's the plaintiff's burden under these circumstances to secure the findings they need. If this was poorly worded, or if the PJC...
They didn't secure the findings that they needed, didn't they?
They didn't secure a finding, an indication that every finding was unanimous, no.
That's not... But earlier you're saying that's not a finding for purposes of a conflict. Now you're saying it is a finding, but not for purposes of a conflict? And is he... Go ahead.
No, Your Honor. The Civil Practices and Remedies Code and the Rules of Civil Procedure require unanimity, a little tongue-tied, on liability, malice or gross negligence, and the amount.
And they got those findings.
But there's no indication that they were unanimous on those.
Other than the fact that they were instructed that they had to be.
One final question. Okay. You don't object to the legal sufficiency of the finding on malice, okay? And the specific finding on malice had to have been, they were instructed that that answer had to be unanimous, okay? They couldn't answer the question unless all of them agreed to the yes answer with regard to malice. And the predicate within the answer itself says, do you think what you answered with regard to three was done maliciously? Why is that not a finding of unanimity with regard to three?
I feel like I'm going around. All I can say is.
So basically, it's just the fact that the verdict says we were not unanimous. Only 11 of us agreed on every answer. That's it. You're hanging your hat on it.
Essentially, yes.
Okay.
I see I'm out of time. I'm reserving the rest for rebuttal. Thank
sure.
you.
May police court. Ms. Donnell complained about sex and age discrimination to two individuals. The individual to whom she complained and whom she complained about, the company said in the interrogatories, was the primary person involved in the decision to terminate. That's Mike Owen.
And that was read to the jury.
And that was read to the jury, sworn in.
And then Larson said, no, it was Campbell. And then Campbell said, no, HR is the one. So I've got three different people making decisions or saying who has the actual authority to do something.
Correct. And that two things about that evidence. One is that evidence is evidence of the pretextual nature of their stated reason, that their stated reason is unworthy of credence because they can't get their story straight about who made the decision. But moreover, there is some evidence supporting the verdict in that Mike Owen was the primary person involved in the decision as evidenced by their sworn answer. So there's evidence with regard to the liability question.
Question. Well, with regard to the eventual email where Campbell says she's got to go, okay? Then there's a responding email from Larson that basically says, hey, I need to talk to you. And then there's an email talking about we need to get together either by conference call or get together with regard to discuss this. So counsel's argument is, Boxer's argument is that the email with regard to she's got to go was the definitive decision made by Campbell. She's the decision maker. There's no evidence before she sends that email that she knows anything with regard to the discriminatory issues going on beforehand, okay? Which, let's leave that for right now. So the question I've got is there any evidence in the record that the conference that's mentioned in the emails actually occurred?
There's no evidence that the conference occurred in the record, but moreover, let's assume that there is. Let's, for sake of argument, let's assume that there is evidence that the conference occurred. The Texas Supreme Court tells us in AutoZone versus Reyes that the cat's paw evidentiary standard of liability can result in a finding of liability. Even if Campbell didn't know about the complaint and was the primary decision maker, because there's evidence that Mike Owen, who was the primary person involved in the decision of the termination, exerted leverage or influence over the decision. Campbell testified that he only found out facts about the email in question, the IHG employee email, from Owen. Owen being the person.
Did Owen's email specifically refer to her as lying in that email? I think your brief says he said she was lying about that particular.
I believe that there is. I don't know that the email uses the word lying. I think the email uses words that call into question her veracity. But in the testimony, she testified that he was indicating to her that
so she for example, your theory is basically, using the word cat's paw, basically if it can be demonstrated that the, assuming Campbell is in fact the primary decision maker and the decision was in fact the email that says she's got to go, but it was in response to an email you're arguing was a cat's paw type of email, manipulative based upon Owen withholding and or shading certain information about your client.
Absolutely, and it's belt and suspenders. We think that there's evidence that Owen was the primary decision maker, that there's no evidence that the meeting occurred, but assume that wasn't the case under City of Keller, I think it is, but assuming it wasn't the case, then the court can also find liability under cat's paw through Campbell.
I'm going blank on the case, but I think you've cited somewhere with regard to what is the standard with regard to, since we're dealing with legal sufficiency, and I think it's somewhere in the charge itself, but can the jury disbelieve testimony and consider that Larson, Campbell, Owen are being untruthful, lack of veracity, et cetera, and then that supplies the liability finding with regard to some evidence in support of the retaliation?
Yes, there's case law, and I'd be glad to provide it to the court. I don't have the name right off the tip of my tongue, but there's case law that says when they can't get straight who made the decision, did, as their interrogatory said, Mike Owen was the primary person involved in the decision. There's testimony that Campbell made the decision, and then Campbell says, no, it's HR. They're all pointing to someone else. Certainly the jury can infer that all of them are not telling the truth and that the real reason is that they're trying to hide illegal discrimination. Justice Scalia in St. Mary's Honor Hall, cited by the Supreme Court in Reeves, his friend Ruth Bader Ginsburg in Reeves, and cited by the Texas Supreme Court in Quantum, said, if you take a prima facie case and then the stated reason for the termination is either false or unworthy of credence, then a jury can infer that the real reason was mendacity for illegal discrimination or retaliation. And so a jury could infer from the fact that none of them are taking ownership of the decision when each of them say someone else made the decision. The company says Mike Owen. The testimony was Campbell made the decision, and Campbell said HR made the decision. A jury can infer that their stated reason for the termination is unworthy of credence because they can't even say consistently who made the decision. So that in and of itself is sufficient to support the jury verdict on liability on retaliation. With regard to exemplary damages, at volume 8, reporter's record 15, the judge says, indicates that she went and talked to the jury and that they indicated at least she talked to them about the last question because she indicates she talks to juries about how they come up with amounts. She indicated that they indicated that that last question was unanimous. That's on the record. The case law in Texas is the presumption is the jury followed the instructions.
But, okay. How are we to give any credence to that whatsoever, even though it's on the record? Okay, that is a conference with the judge and the jury about their deliberations, and then she comes back out and puts it on the record?
I don't know that there's a rule that prohibits her from putting that on the record. All I would urge is that evidence undermines their argument that.
Well, there's plenty of case law with regard to our not being able to go into jury deliberations after the fact.
The fact that
she's done it and then feels free enough to put it on the record after the fact doesn't necessarily allow us to take into consider her finding of what occurred.
I think that's a correct statement of the law, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think that it just supports, but it also supports the reason that rule that we don't go into the mental processes of the jury is why we have the presumption that the jury follows the instruction. And the with regard to the questions, the instructions say that all of the three findings that were required here be unanimous, and that the verdict was that at least 11 of the jurors agreed to the answer on every question. There was one juror who indicated that he would have found age discrimination.
Do you think that was a conflict between the instructions that they were given and the verdict form that they returned and the questions that they returned in court?
No, it wasn't a conflict because they followed the court's instruction, and there's nothing in the verdict form that requires that you indicate that there be 11 jurors for each question. In fact, the Texas Supreme Court has promulgated amendments to Rule 226A, which says that a party may, if they want, obtain certifications with regard to the other questions. They didn't object to the charge. They didn't tender a certification question. And so there is not a conflict. But even if there were a conflict, it was their burden to object. They say, well, they're trying to try their case, and it would be very difficult to ask the jury to go back. Well, that burden is on them, and they didn't. If it were a conflict, it was their duty to object, but they didn't.
Why
object.
Is it their duty to object?
Well, because they're the ones that have an issue with.
Yeah, but you're the one who has the burden to get the findings that are apparent on the face of the record that you have unanimity. Right now, you're relying upon an inference that they followed the instructions, but it was your burden to get the unanimous decision, wasn't it?
It was our burden to obtain a unanimous finding, and given the instructions, it was our understanding. It was clear that the jury obtained a unanimous finding because they went on and answered questions 4 and 5. With regard to the issue of compensatory damages, they take issue and say there's no evidence of mental anguish. I would provide the court there is evidence that she went and visited with a counselor, and there's evidence of mental anguish and how it disrupted her life. But even if there
is there evidence that she went to the counselor post-termination? I know there's plenty of evidence with regard to her going to the counselor beforehand, but is there any evidence of her going to the counselor after she was terminated?
I believe that it is in the counselor's records that she went back, but I'm going to have to confirm that for you.
Were those records in evidence for the jury to consider during their deliberations?
I believe so, because they take issue with the.
I know what parts of the therapist's records they want to talk about, but the entirety of the records put in for the jury?
I don't know that the entirety was, but I believe that she went on and visited with the counselor.
Is there any, I don't remember in the briefing, is there any, given the fact that the word inconvenience is actually used in the labor code here with regard to the damages that can be awarded, is there any case law that differentiates if in fact the compensatory damage language from the statute, which includes inconvenience and mental anguish as elements of damage, and they're not broken down, has any court actually broken down and said what inconvenience is versus the other? I know you cited one case where they talked about, well, because inconvenience is also a possible thing here, we can't determine what the jury did, we're going to go ahead and let it stand. Has any case actually said how Parkway interacts with that statutory language?
No. And short answer is
or
no.
Or Woodruff, or which, however you want to put it.
Short answer is no, and I've looked for it repeatedly over the years. No court has examined what inconvenience is under the statute. And so I would urge the court.
Well, and I'm just using it because there's other language in there too. But my point is one of the arguments you make is that because they don't challenge the evidentiary basis for any of the other elements, that $32,000 is perfectly fine. If the jury could have found no mental anguish whatsoever but awarded $32,000 for an inconvenience, but they don't challenge the evidence with regard to inconvenience.
Correct.
Okay.
And that is, that while we think there is sufficient evidence of mental anguish, assuming that there's not, assuming arguendo that there's not, they haven't challenged loss of enjoyment of life or inconvenience or the other, those two main other elements of non-economic compensatory damages. And so they've waived any error.
Okay. Let me ask you this. With regard to back pay, their position is there's legal insufficiency, but it's different than usual no evidence. In this instance, it's a conclusive evidence to the contrary. By taking her resignation, the therapy records with regard to I'm intending to or plan to, et cetera, and not only does she plan to, but she does a resignation letter, and not only that, but my recollection of the record is she hands it to Owen after she's fired and basically says, I was going to resign anyway. Okay. What is it about the termination before she actually does that that negates the conclusive evidence aspect of it? Because that appears to be conclusive evidence.
Well, but it's not the but-for cause. The but-for cause that the jury, and the question that the jury was asked was, what were her damages as a result of being terminated for the retaliatory discharge? If she hadn't been fired, the question is, would she have, would she have resigned? It really is speculation what she would have done had she not been fired. I've got a to-do list. On my to-do list the last 2 weeks, I've had get Mother's Day present. It's still on my to-do list. I hope I get it done by Sunday, but that doesn't mean conclusively that I will get it done by Sunday.
Well, then this gets into the issue of whether it's an affirmative defense or not. And so on the one hand, the argument is that because you have to show what, in fact, your damages were, okay, and there is a presumption that if you are terminated that you would have worked until the actual judgment, okay? And that's what you're talking about here in terms of the damages, all right? So, but, and I've lost my train of thought for a second. Somebody save me.
Well I think the question with regard to mitigation is the burden of on the duty of to mitigate is on them and to obtain
finding. That's okay. So the question is does the case law that was cited suggests that there has to be a finding by the jury of when that resignation before judgment would have occurred for purposes of determining when the resignation would have happened. Are you arguing that they needed to obtain a finding when all the case law really says is that that presumption shifts over to them to show that, in fact, a resignation would have occurred before judgment at some point in time?
Under Texas law, the duty to mitigate is their burden to show that she didn't mitigate her damages.
Well, but mitigation is a different animal, but because the back pay issue is tied to something akin to mitigation, even on a mitigation, that's an evidentiary issue, is it not? They don't have to obtain a finding on mitigation.
Well, they certainly can argue with regard to the duty to mitigate. It's certainly their duty, it's their burden to show that she did not mitigate her damages. And the evidence shows she only had $32,000 of lost wages. That's because she went and found another job. The resignation issue is really a question of would her damages really have cut off. That's not what the jury found. The jury found that she was terminated and she had those damages because of her termination. The fact that she talked about her resignation after she was terminated really is of no moment. The jury can say, well, she didn't resign before she was terminated, and who knows what she would have done if she wasn't terminated.
Okay.
Unless you have any... the last thing I'd like to mention is on the issue of attorney's fees. There's several cases out of the Texas Supreme Court, especially recent cases, but starting with L. Apple, which was actually a Chapter 21 of the Labor Code case, the court had a duty to find the necessary hours worked by the expended by the attorneys in this case and the reasonable hourly rate. Those were requested under findings. There's a request for past two findings on those two issues, and the court did not.
Well, has the court specifically said that under Rormus to the bench that there have to be lodestar findings? In other words, the adjudicating court has to make a determination about what the reasonable hours were under the circumstances, what the reasonable rate was under the circumstances, and what the multiplier should be, if any, under those circumstances for purposes of, has there been any discussion about our ability to review whether or not the lodestar was actually used under the circumstances if there are no findings?
Well, my reading of Rormus, and certainly my reading of L. Apple, was that the finding of necessary time and reasonable hourly rate are required. So that's my reading of those cases, that those two things are required.
But nobody's actually specifically said that. In other words, nobody's done what you're asking us to do, which is find that because Judge Fitzpatrick didn't make any of those three findings, that it's subject to reversal and we got to kick it back for her to make those findings if we get that far.
That's correct. There's been no holding on what I would say is the next step of what the failure to make those findings, as the Texas Supreme Court observes, should be found in L. Apple and Rormus, what the effect is if the court does not.
Okay.
Unless you have any other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you. I'd like to clear up one or two things with talking about the final decision maker. What I hope the court understands is that people are characterizing this as people blaming each other for the decision. What the testimony was that Shelley Campbell is Mike Owen's supervisor. So she has authority above him to make or disagree with the decision. And that Larson, as the HR person, has a veto. And what the evidence is in this case is that Mike Owen, in his email, he didn't say, I want to fire Ms. Donnell. He said, I want to talk about the next steps. Shelley Campbell immediately comes in after seeing the email, and it's not a question of whether she was lying to IHG or not. The issue was that Ms. Donnell took an internal issue that could be embarrassing and looped in an important franchisor, and in the middle of some problems the hotel was having with IHG, and it created a very embarrassing situation. In fact, IHG immediately responded with, what do you mean she doesn't have the access? And then they come back and have a meeting and proceed with the decision already made to be terminated. And it would be our position that the cat's paw theory doesn't, or at least shouldn't apply when a decision has already been made, and even if someone comes in later that may have a retaliatory intent, and you discuss it and the intent goes forward, there's not influence on that decision that has already been made to terminate. So I just wanted to clarify that issue.
Well, would you not agree that the case law makes it clear that the decision to terminate, to retaliate, doesn't have to be unique, in other words, solely a decision to retaliate, that as long as there is some retaliatory intent, there could also be a valid, meritorious basis for terminating somebody combined.
I would agree, but in this situation, the person who made it, Shelley Campbell, had no knowledge of a prior allegation of discrimination by Ms. Donnell.
Okay, did she not meet with Owen and Donnell, and Owen specifically tell her about the October 2018 aggressiveness? I mean, Donnell tell her specifically about the aggressive incident?
There was the word aggressive, but there's no indication that it was on the basis of gender or age. The other testimony was that he does this with everyone. That's not an allegation of discrimination. You can argue what she was saying is he's a horrible manager. He should be terminated. That does not trigger the anti-retaliation protections in the labor code, is my point.
Okay.
Going back to the issue of exemplary damages, if you look in the docket sheet of the court, the trial court, it's in volume 2, page 748. At the bottom, there was discussion about Judge Fitzpatrick going in and talking to the jury. If you're going to consider that, she makes the notation, 11-1 for retaliation. Jury was unanimous for exemplaries. So this is another indication in the record that it was not unanimous.
Okay, and you know of all the case law that says we can't look at a docket sheet entry.
But opposing counsel brought it
point,
up. If you're going to consider it, that's something you should consider also would be my point. Fair enough?
Fair enough. But I seem to recall grilling him a little bit about Judge Fitzpatrick going into deliberations to begin with and putting it on the record. So
going to pack.
Let's say I'm not enamored of either one of those, considering either one of those things.
Fair enough. On the issue of back pay, two things I think need to be considered. First of all, even if it wasn't an affirmative defense, which we cited case law that says it isn't, it was tried by consent. Mr. Uloff brought it up in opening statements. He brought it up on direct. Before I had an opportunity to say a single thing at trial, he brought up the issue of her quitting early. If it wasn't an affirmative defense, which I claim it isn't, it was tried by consent because he brought it up.
Did y'all argue that she was going to resign anyway and therefore there was no back pay? In other words, what was argued with regard to the amount that should be or should not be put in that blank by the jury?
Your Honor, I brought up in a motion in limine that was granted that constructive discharge had not even been pled. It wasn't argued. There was no evidence of it submitted. So the issue of, well, she would have resigned anyway, wasn't a part of the pleadings, the evidence, or anything, or the fact of a constructive discharge. I would have quit anyway. And one final thing, the standard for back pay by this court in Shearcuts versus Littlejohn and Goodman versus Page is the correct measure of damages for lost wages is the amount of money the employee would have earned had she not been terminated. In this case, if she had not been terminated, she would have come in an hour or two later and submitted her resignation. But
my point is that's that issue, back pay, is submitted to the jury. The jury's being asked to put a monetary number in that, okay? And so did you actually argue, ladies and gentlemen, even if you find liability, da-da-da-da-da, which we don't think you should for these reasons, did you argue damages at all and just say, look, she shouldn't be given any back pay because she would have resigned that day anyway?
I don't want to make any misrepresentation to the court. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure, but I'm
okay. The reason
I did
I'm asking,
final arguments, I'm pretty sure I argued that.
Well, the reason I'm asking that is because we have to look at it to determine whether or not her testimony that she was going to resign is conclusive, okay, with regard to that particular issue. and that no jury could have reasonably awarded any damages or found that she would not have resigned under the circumstances, okay? And so that's why I'm asking that question. Was the jury actually told you shouldn't be able to award any damages here because in fact she would have resigned, so she's not out any money here. So you should answer zero to this.
It was not in the jury charge.
Okay.
I can say that, but I'm fairly confident it was argued.
Okay.
If there's no other questions, I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. All righty. Thank you all very much. Thank you for putting up with me. And the case is submitted. We appreciate the argument, and we will get back with y'all. Thank y'all very much.